Live from the great American Northwest, it's Pro Libertate Radio, a full throttle, no holds barred examination of the threats to life, liberty, and property. Now, here's our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Gregg.
Drop what you're doing. Two paths converged in the wood, or you have the sliding doors scenario. There are decision points, there are little fractal collisions in the multiverse. There are little moments where people zig rather than zagging. I was just having a conversation with Denny, our board op, about one such moment in my life about 23 years ago when given the opportunity to tour with the Jets. Does anybody else remember the Jets? An ensemble that had a number of hits in the and Denny's reciting some of their hits in my earphones here. But they had a number of hits back in the late 1980s of rhythm and blues infused pop. And they were a family band, and I was offered an opportunity to tour as a sideman. What happened is that a friend of mine who was a singer was dating one of the Jets, and her boyfriend, they mentioned the fact that they were looking for a guitar player to be one of their backup ensemble. And she said, "Hey, I know just the guy. He even looks like you." What happened is that rather than pursuing that opportunity, I went to Washington, D.C. on a journalism fellowship. Now, that's what happened in this reality. Now, if you subscribe to the multiverse theory, and I don't know whether or not I do. As a matter of fact, I'm pretty sure I don't. But just for goofs and giggles, let's pursue this line of thought. That was a quantum decision point, and that butted off in two different directions. In one universe, I went on to become a journalist, and in another universe, I went on to wealth and power and fame as a musician. So we're stuck with this version. I don't know. I think what I'm doing is worthwhile. It's just not particularly remunerative. In any case, this is Pro Libertate Radio, and I am your host, William Grigg. And as I mentioned a couple of times earlier in earlier hours of this program, we're live tonight, unlike last week, owing to technical problems that appear to be in hand. Last week, I wasn't able to be live. This week, I am live, and I'd love to hear from you. Our call-in number is 866-986-6397. 866-986-6397 on the Liberty News Radio Network. If you have the chance, please go to my blog this evening. Pro Libertate, the blog, is found at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. In the first hour and part of the second hour, I discussed the current essay, which is at the top of the blog, The Kidnapping of Cheyenne Irish in Concord, New Hampshire, by government officials just a couple of days ago. It is a huge story that's finally getting a little bit of attention from the government-aligned media. I think that's a far better description than mainstream press. And the most important facts in that controversy, in my opinion, are the following. I've said this a couple of times, and I'll reiterate it because it's that important. If there are legitimate suspicions of actual crimes against the mother and the stepchildren in this rather troubled domestic arrangement, the child in question should not be kidnapped from the mother at gunpoint in the hospital. The alleged abuser should be taken into custody. They didn't do that. And I suspect the reason they took the child rather than the alleged abuser is they want to use the leverage of kidnapping the child to get the alleged abuser and his purported victim, both of whom ardently deny that he is an abuser, to undergo government-mandated indoctrination taught by somebody who believes that he has both the skill and the mandate to force somebody to convert to the gospel of political correctness from the inside out. Tolerance is not enough, says Scott Hampton, the person who operates that program. You have to reconfigure the human personality from the inside out. As a Christian, I believe that that's God's gig, solely and exclusively. Government has no cause, calling, jurisdiction, or competence to be pursuing that type of reformation. And that falls squarely into the category that C.S. Lewis described as humanitarian totalitarianism presided over by official straighteners. So the essay dealing with this is at the top of the blog, Pro Libertate, the blog, freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Here's an essay at lewrockwell.com that I want to share with you. 12 ominous signs for world financial markets. Number one, corporate insiders are getting out of the U.S. stock market at an absolutely blinding pace. It is being reported that the ratio of corporate insider selling to corporate insider buying last week was 1,411 to 1, and this week the ratio has soared even higher and is 2,341 to 1. We're not hearing a whole lot about that. That's an important bit of the story. Number two, many of the world's wealthiest people are buying absolutely massive quantities of gold right now. You didn't mention it, but a necessary codicil to that observation is that there are efforts underway right now to demonize and persecute and ultimately perhaps to prosecute on spurious charges gold bullion dealers here in the United States. I think that's an anticipatory measure to confiscation of gold by somebody who is not part of the politically protected elite. Number three, it is being reported that J.P. Morgan is gobbling up the rights to as much physical gold as it possibly can. Number four, the United States Mint has announced that it has run out of 1 ounce, 24-karat American Buffalo Gold bullion coins, and they will not be selling any more of them in 2010. That's ominous indeed. Number five, it is becoming increasingly difficult to explain the unusually high option volume that we are witnessing right now. Number six, some very large investors are making massive bets that the S&P 500 is going to take a serious tumble during the month of October. October, by the way, is usually the month. Toward the end of October, in particularly, is usually the time when things get really nasty in the marketplace. You recall that 2 years ago, we had the October Revolution in this country, which brought about this new political and economic order of things in which the barons of Wall Street are now essentially the biggest welfare whores in human history. I'll get back to this essay in just a second. We do have a caller. James from South Carolina has joined us. How are you this evening, James? Welcome to the program. James, it's good to hear from you.
I asked you something about a month ago, and you said you didn't know, and I think you said you'd look into it.
I probably am still mired in my ignorance, unfortunately. What did you ask me about?
Well, I've asked you a couple of times about the National Guard and the relationship to the federal government. But one time I asked you, who was getting the National Guard to do these things within the state, like in New York, I think in Albany, I've heard they've made lots of arrests, the National Guard has, and other places they're doing different things. And I ask, who is doing this? I mean, is it the governor in each state that's doing it? Or is it the...
What usually happens, and this is one of those questions where I end up in a mare's nest of administrative details that I think exist for the purpose of preventing those of us who are not part of the consecrated elite from finding out exactly who's responsible for what's going on. But in the specific case that you mentioned in New York, you're dealing with National Guardsmen who are part of a multi-jurisdictional federal task force that is a program that the governor has to sign off on. But it's something that starts, it originates in Washington, D.C. So what happens is that the governor is given an opt-in, but it doesn't start with the governor. It comes down from Washington, D.C., and owing to the pressure of subsidies, something he signs off on. Could you stay with us for the break, James?
Okay.
Okay, James will join us on the other side of the break. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio, 866-986-6397. We'll be back in just a minute with James from South Carolina. Welcome back. We're discussing the National Guard once again with James from South Carolina, and he has a question that I've been looking into, and owing to a number of factors, not the least of which is the rather chaotic circumstances I find myself in working out of my home with six energetic and curious young children, I've not been able to do due diligence on this to the extent that I should, and I apologize for that, James, but before the break, we were talking about the fact that a lot of these initiatives begin with Washington, D.C. They begin in Washington, D.C., and then you have the governors where the National Guard is involved with an opt-in or opt-out opportunity, and often because of the fact that they're receiving money from the federal government, from the Pentagon and the Justice Department particularly – they don't interdict, they don't interpose, I think is a better word, when their National Guard is being used for purposes that I think are manifestly unconstitutional. But here's a really good example from your state, as it happens. This is from, let's see, where did I find this article? The Post and Courier of, what town is the Post and Courier from?
Charleston.
But it's in South Carolina. I'm sorry?
Charleston.
Charleston, South Carolina, Post and Courier from February 2009. It's referring to something called Project 9496. Have you heard of that?
Have not.
Okay. The pilot program would target a stealthy underworld of drugs and money. The new unit is shrouded in secrecy with scant details of its origin, funding, and status. The Pentagon refers to the program as Project 9496. Colonel Pete Brooks, excuse me, Director of Public Affairs for the South Carolina National Guard, said it's too early to talk about the effort in detail. We are not even out of the blocks yet. This whole new mission is at the good idea stage and is not funded. But a January 14th letter from Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense Richard J. Douglas to the National Guard Bureau indicates that the pilot program is already approved. The letter states that the South Carolina Counter-Narco-Terrorism Pilot Program is to be run and funded separately from an existing network of states' National Guard counter-drug units. Now, there are two revelations in that sentence, the first of which is that you have this off-the-books, super-secret, need-to-know, I-could-tell-you-more-but-then-I'd-have-to-kill-you type of program. But there's also acknowledgement of an existing network of states' National Guard counter-drug units. They're all being run out of the Pentagon, James. They're not being run on the authority of the legislatures of the various states and presided over by the state governors. Brooks said the pilot program would expand the South Carolina Guard's anti-drug unit, which employs 40 full-time employees and hires about a dozen temporary workers each summer to help destroy marijuana crops, which, by the way, is not an appropriate use of the state National Guard, unless the legislature of the state decides that it should be used in that fashion and the governor, on his own authority, signs off on it. The program receives about $1.6 million in federal money each year in support of the drug eradication efforts of SLED, that's the Narcotics Eradication Program, and local police agencies. How the agencies would partner under the pilot program is unclear because SLED considers it only an idea at this point, according to the, to a statement the agency issued in response to questions from the newspaper. Exactly how much the program would cost also remains unclear. Now, that's what I'm talking about, James. They make things so convoluted and opaque precisely because they don't want you to know who's responsible. They don't want to have a traceable chain of authority that would allow people to walk back the cat, to use the intelligence phrase, and determine the origins of this proposal. In under the constitutional scheme, it's all very clear. The National Guard is a organization of the citizens' militia in a given state that is mustered by the legislature and presided over by the governor. The legislature establishes regulations, funds the mission, is in control of the mission. The governor acts as the civilian command authority for the state National Guard. But that's increasingly an archaism in this system, where I would be willing to bet that the governor of South Carolina can't even answer you if you asked him the question, where does this come from? Who's responsible for it? How much money is being spent? Who's in charge of it? How would we go about eradicating it? I bet he couldn't even answer those questions, James.
I will look.
That's right there in South Carolina. I'm sorry?
I say I will look into it a little bit.
Please do. I'd be fascinated to learn what you find out.
Okay. Why do you think this is being done? I would find it difficult to believe that the Pentagon cares what about marijuana being grown in South Carolina. I don't think they do.
No, they don't.
What do you think the ultimate reason is that they are subsidizing these different kind of things around the country?
I suspect, and this is my cynicism, my cultured, cultivated, and learned cynicism, the cynicism born of experience speaking, that this is the easiest and most effective way to make sure that you have assets in place. They're busy, they're engaged, they're getting training in quasi-combat situations, and most importantly, they're under the control of the Pentagon, not under the control of the state and local officials. They're not accountable to the local population. They're not accountable to the legislature. The money's coming from Washington, and you're building and reinforcing an order of battle that is controlled by Washington, D.C., with what amounts to a standing army of occupation to the extent that they're involved in these efforts across the country. And they use the martial lexicon to describe what they're doing when they're involved in counter-narcotics. They approach it as a military deployment. In my writing on this in the blog, I've quoted officials, for instance, in New York State from the National Guard saying that this is a combat mission. That's how they approach it. And there are people in the Pentagon and in the civilian element of the Pentagon particularly who really do want to have a standing army of occupation in this country for the purposes of, well, bringing about the submission of those of us who might get ideas about independence from Washington's control. I think it's that well advanced. The disease of militarist centralized tyranny is that advanced, in my opinion.
Well, if they're doing marijuana in South Carolina and alcohol checks in New York, this is, does not seem to be very well coordinated. Are you aware of any national coordinated thing that, say, all of the National Guard does nationwide?
I think they probably do adapt it to local situations and circumstances, but this article did make mention of a, quote, existing network of states' National Guard counter-drug units. They're not all necessarily carrying out the same program, but the most important thing is not what they're doing in terms of the specific boots-on-the-ground mission in a given state or a given community. The most important thing is that they're all marching to a tune that is being performed in Washington, D.C., rather than being performed in their state capital. I think that's the really important point of all of this.
Well,
but like I said, this is something I'm still looking into. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I find this frightening.
I find it terrifying.
Yeah, I
think you're very wise to be frightened by this, James.
Well, I will look into it.
I'll continue to look into it, too, and watch the blog, because I'm going to be writing about this.
Okay.
I promise you I'm going to be learning what I can and reporting what I learn.
Okay. Thank you, Will.
Thanks so much for calling in. God bless you. It's good to hear from you. It's also worth pointing out, in connection with the subject James brings up of the National Guard being involved in counter-narcotics, which is not a suitable use of the National Guard, that this was one of the ways during the late 1980s and early 1990s that we ended up with active duty military involved in drug interdiction, both here and abroad. Right now, you've got the Marines. I think you've got, what, a division of Marines in Costa friggin' Rica. What are they doing in Costa Rica? Well, first of all, Costa Rica doesn't have a military, so they're a pushover. That's the way Washington rolls. That's the way the empire aggrandizes itself. It makes sure that it picks on people who can't fight back. You know, they basically want to have a homecoming game every week. That's how imperial military policy is played out. But they're in Costa Rica, purportedly for counter-narcotics reasons. They're building military base there. It's the same type of pretext that's just applied internationally. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio, 866-986-6397 is our call-in number. We'll be back at you in just a minute.
System memory crash.
Now, back to our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Grigg.
Just to round off the discussion that concluded at the end of the last segment regarding the National Guard, it's very important, I think, to bear in mind that in exceptional circumstances that are becoming less the exception and more the rule, the National Guard is involved in hands-on law enforcement. This was something that was previewed in great detail during the 2008 Republican National Conventions in the Twin Cities and Denver, respectively. The National Guard deployed to provide defense in depth, I guess, for the political conventions and to be a backline to lend support to the police, who were, of course, outfitted in riot gear and approached crowd control literally as a paramilitary exercise, or in the case of the National Guard, as an actual military deployment. If you go to my blog, Pro Libertate, and you go to the search engine at the top of the computer page, or the top of the page there, the computer search engine, type in Rubicon, R-U-B-I-C-O-N, Rubicon in the rear view. And that series talks about, among other things, the increasing commingling of National Guard and law enforcement. And particularly as an example of this, goes in the description of what happened at the RNC and DNC, the national conventions, in 2008. I actually have a video that I linked to from the National Guard Command that was involved in the 2008 Republican National Committee or Convention talking about this as a deployment. He was literally giving a pep talk to his troops before they were deployed in a mission that he said they should take as seriously as any other deployment overseas. That is so staggeringly incompatible with the notion of a constitutional republic where you have a hard black letter separation between law enforcement and military under the Posse Comitatus Act, and more importantly, under the specific enumeration of powers and responsibilities that was made at the time of the founding. But that's the world we live in right now, and is becoming, as James pointed out, a more and more commonplace thing to see National Guard soldiers who are not guardsmen or militia, but soldiers under central command from the Pentagon, conducting routine and increasingly commonplace law enforcement activities, whether you're talking about narcotics eradication or lending support for narcotics, counter-narcotics strikes, or conducting roadblocks and checkpoints. That's where we are right now. Now, to return to this litany of ill tidings from LouRockwell.com, 12 ominous signs for world financial markets. We just talked about the fact that some very large investors, this is number six on that list, are making massive bets that the S&P 500 is going to take a serious tumble during the month of October. Number seven, on Tuesday, that's Tuesday last, the Bank of Japan shocked world financial markets by cutting interest rates even closer to zero and by setting up a 5 trillion yen quantitative easing fund. Quantitative easing, of course, is inflation. That refers to the monetization of debt. Quantitative easing is a term of art that has been very commonplace in recent days. And that leads us to point number eight. The president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago are both publicly urging the Fed to do much more to stimulate the U.S. economy, including beginning a new round of quantitative easing, even if it means a significant rise in the U.S. inflation rate. By inflation rate, they're referring to price inflation, which is the symptom of the underlying illness, which is monetary inflation. Number nine, Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz told reporters on Tuesday that the loose monetary policies of the Federal Reserve and European Central Bank are throwing the world into, quote, chaos. Number 10, at the end of September, federal regulators announced a $30 billion bailout of the U.S. wholesale credit union system. Number 11, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, and GMAC, General Motors, I don't know what AC stands for, GMAC Mortgage, have all suspended foreclosures in many U.S. states due to serious concerns about foreclosure procedures. Now, Texas Attorney General Greg Abbott is actually demanding that all mortgage servicing companies in the state of Texas immediately suspend all foreclosures, the selling of foreclosed properties, and the eviction of people living in foreclosed properties until they have completed a review of their foreclosure procedures. Number 12, not only that, but Nancy Pelosi and 30 other members of Congress are requesting a federal investigation of the foreclosure practices of U.S. mortgage lenders. Needless to say, this controversy has the potential to turn the entire U.S. mortgage industry into an absolute quagmire, as opposed to a near absolute quagmire, which is where we find ourselves right now. He's talking about an unqualified quagmire. I suppose right now there is some pretense that that quagmire is something less than the mess it actually is. So, continues the piece, are dark days ahead for world financial markets? Well, yeah, but it is incredibly hard to predict exactly when things are going to fall apart. The truth is that there are going to be a whole lot more crashes and collapses in the years ahead. The important thing, as discussed yesterday, is to keep your eye on the long-term trends. The U.S. economy is undeniably in decline. The only thing keeping the economy going at this point is a rapidly growing sea of red ink. Debt is literally everywhere. It is what our entire financial system is based on in 2010. Let me digress here from this article briefly to make a point or to flesh out more thoroughly the point that this author just made. This, by the way, is reprinted on lewrockwell.com from the Economic Collapse blog. Debt is what the monetary system of the United States has been based on since the Federal Reserve System was inflicted upon it in 1913. I am of the opinion that that system is going to be in full-orbed collapse before it is a century old. Anytime a government creates a central bank that is capable of issuing a currency that is backed to any extent on debt, Gresham's law dictates that eventually debt will be the only quantity backing the currency whatsoever. Bad money, bad currency, that is, drives out good. That's what's happening right now. If you look at your Federal Reserve note, that gaudily decorated piece of rag paper that we're told to call money, what does the legal tender notice on that instrument say? It is legal tender for the payment of debts, both public and private. If there were no debt in the system, would there be any subjective value to the Federal Reserve note? I contend that there would not be. Now, if you're talking about something that has value that is considered to be innate, if you're talking about property, if you're talking about a good or a service that we would pay for, would exchange something for, its value is not a function of debt, indebtedness. You don't have to use something of that sort in order to, rather, you don't have to have a debt in existence in order to make the use of that quantum of property or that particular service worthwhile. A piece of gold will always have value. As long as human beings have been involved in some kind of currency exchange, gold, to the best of our records, as far as our recorded history indicates, gold has been considered to be an item of innate value. You don't have to have a debt to be settled in order for gold to be considered worthwhile. I will take gold even though you don't owe me money. I will take gold if you want something and you want to offer me gold in exchange for it. But in order for the Federal Reserve note to be useful, there has to be a debt behind it. That's because it's backed by the full faith and credit of the world's largest debtor. That is the federal government of the United States. Now, there was a time when the Federal Reserve note was contending with other forms of currency. There was a time when the government issued Federal Reserve notes that didn't involve debt, but rather could be exchanged for something considered to be of innate value, whether it's gold or silver. The penultimate version of the Federal Reserve note, which was taken out of circulation a little more than 40 years ago, said that the Federal Reserve note in question, the note in question, could be exchanged for the equivalent quantity of legal money at a Federal Reserve bank. It didn't define what legal money was. Legal money, of course, according to the Constitution, is either gold or silver. Before that, of course, you had silver certificates and gold certificates. You could exchange that note for the equivalent value of gold or silver. By the end of the 1960s, of course, because of the indebtedness of the U.S. government, they stopped allowing dollars to be exchanged for gold and silver. The French had something to do with this. Charles Goyette, in his wonderful book on the meltdown of the economy, talks about the fact that because the French government was not willing to exchange dollars for other dollars but demanded gold, the federal government decided to close the gold window. That had a lot to do with the decision to get the United States off the gold standard. But debt's the only thing backing it. Debt's all we're dealing with, and pretty soon we're going to be drowning in it, literally. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio, 866-986-6397. We'll be back at you in just a minute. We'd love to hear from you in the final segment of this program. isn't paranoia to believe that the secret police, which I guess is how you'd have to refer to the FBI in light of our discussion this evening, have honeycombed this country with informants and provocateurs. Every time we read or hear about the FBI interdicting a terrorist plot somewhere, we have to assume that the plot in question had been scripted at Quantico and that the patsies who are gathered up and paraded before the cameras were organized by somebody on the payroll of the FBI. Every once in a while, we learn about an attempt to ignite a plot of this sort that turns out to be a damp squib. Now, a couple of segments ago, I was talking about this Afifi fellow from Santa Clara who discovered, much to his horror, that his car had been bugged by the FBI for a number of months. And after he made note of this fact on the Internet, he was visited by the Cheka, by the FBI and a handful of local police, and threatened in various ways in an act of intimidation. My suspicion is that the reason why he was being bugged and surveilled was they wanted to turn him into an informant provocateur. They wanted to use him as an asset in creating one of these prefabricated terrorist plots that could then be busted by the same FBI that had incited it and used to generate headlines and promotions and so forth. Here's another really good example of the same. This is also from California. This is from Orange County, California. The headline just a couple of days ago read, "Case raises questions about FBI tactics against Muslims." The dateline is Santa Ana, California. This is from October 7th. "Muslim leaders are calling on the Department of Justice to look into the FBI's handling of an investigation against a Southern California man who once faced immigration charges and accusations of being a terrorist sympathizer. Charges against Ahmadullah Saiz Niazi of Tustin, California, have been dismissed, and now Muslim leaders want authorities to look into how FBI agents handled the three-year-long investigation against the Afghan native." Long story short, this guy was accused of lying on his application for a visa by concealing the fact that somebody distantly related to him was accused of having connections to Al-Qaeda. The reason why he did this, assuming he did this, he's never been charged for, let me see, he has been charged formally with this, but the charges were dropped by the federal government. The reason why he did this allegedly would make perfect sense. He didn't have anything to do with Al-Qaeda, but by virtue of the fact that the federal government's pursuing a strategy, a legal strategy, which is specifically forbidden by the Constitution, it's called corruption of blood, he thought it was probably not a good idea to make mention of the fact that his sister was married to somebody connected to a person allegedly involved in Al-Qaeda. That's what provoked the interest in him. Now, to the end of establishing that this guy was somehow involved in terrorism, the FBI concocted another Rube Goldbergian plot involving an informant. The informant's name, informant provocateur, not just an informant, not just there to find out what's going on, he's there to try to cause trouble, was Craig Montili. I'm sure I'm not pronouncing that correctly. Montiel. I'll call him Craig Montiel. I'll see if I can find a news account in which his name is actually pronounced. You know, I have in my hand a series of legal documents that have direct bearing on this case. They were filed in the Superior Court of the State of California, County of Orange, Harbor Justice Center, Newport Beach facility in March of 2009. This is the chronology given in this document. "On or about July 2006, writes Mr. Montiel, I was approached by FBI agent Tracy Hanlon, who asked me if I was interested in work that involved matters of national security. I was asked to infiltrate mosques in Orange County area for the purpose of identifying, thwarting, disrupting, and or destroying terrorist operations. At the time, he was employed by a gym. I agreed to assist her in the FBI and began attending services at the Islamic Center of Irvine in July 2006. I attended their daily prayers at least three times a day and attended Friday prayers at the mosque for 11 months. Parenthetically, you know what you call somebody who attends religious services at a mosque and joins in prayers? You call him a Muslim. This guy was recruited to become a Muslim by the FBI. From the Islamic point of view, if you make the declaration that is part of the formula in worship, you are considered a Muslim. Now, there's a First Amendment issue involved here, I think. From July 2006 to June 2007, he continues, I also attended various other Islamic practices and events during that same time period. While attending those events, I used the name Farouk al-Aziz. That's like John Smith. At the direction of agents Paul Allen and Kevin Armstrong, I used the Islamic Center as a forum to advance an agenda that involved organizing terrorist activities, making reference to jihad, holy war, and organizing terrorist plots and or activities. At the direction of these agents, who told me that my activities were at their direction pursuant to a national security directive called Operation Flex, which was signed by President Bush as Executive Order Number 12356. Once again, the writing here is a little bit terrible. That's a sentence fragment. I was told by agents Allen and Armstrong that the National Security Director was put into action by the authority of Assistant Director of the Los Angeles Region of the FBI, J. Stephen Tidwell, along with Special Agent in Charge Barbara Walls. I was told by my handlers that the United States intelligence community had raw intelligence that indicated that certain members of the Islamic community in Orange County were plotting terrorist acts in Orange County. Raw intelligence, by the way, are rumors. From July 2006 to October 2007, I operated as a confidential informant for the FBI by infiltrating specific mosques in the Islamic community. I reported to the FBI every day by a written report. I always carried electronic video and listening devices on my person for purposes of gathering intelligence. I also collected emails of suspected terrorist activity. A majority of these emails were from Amadullah Saiz Niazi, who as of February 19, 2009, was arrested by the Joint Terrorism Task Force agents for his ties to Al-Qaeda and is currently in custody as a result of my efforts. Late May 2007, I was contacted by mosque attorney Omar Siddiqui, who requested that I stop attending prayers, and he was made subject to a restraining order. Now, here's the other document in this case that I find really interesting. Excuse me. At the direction of the FBI, the informant, Craig Montiel, attempted to infiltrate and spy on the activities of the members of the mosque in an effort to uncover potential terrorists and plots against the government. He was instructed by his handlers to act in a manner that suggested that he was a terrorist in an effort to uncover any potential terrorists or potential terrorist operations against the government. So, here he is at an Islamic center. He's surrounded by Muslims. He says that he wants to wage jihad. Now, naturally, the savagely bearded Mohammedans embraced him because he's a fellow in the struggle against the infidels. How dare these women walk around unshrouded in the public streets? How dare these men not make submission to Allah and his prophet? Why don't we see this sort of a scenario resulting in mushroom clouds or in sudden acts of what's called sudden jihad syndrome, where Muslims simply run amok and start killing people? That's to be expected, of course, if somebody shows up at a mosque speaking the language of jihad, right? Wrong. This is what happened. His actions made many of the members of the mosque uncomfortable, and the attorney for the mosque, Omar Siddiqui, contacted him in an effort to get him to stop attending regular prayers. In other words, they sniffed this guy out as a terrorist, and they said, we don't want to have anything to do with you. That's not what we're about. From their perspective, they gathered on Friday night to worship God, not to plot acts of terrorism. When somebody showed up starting to talk like a terrorist, they figured either he was a real terrorist, or B, a federal infiltrator, or C, both. And they wanted to have nothing to do with him. His actions made many members of the mosque uncomfortable. The attorney contacted him in an effort to get him to stop attending regular prayers. He did receive copies of the application for restraining order, but at the direction of his handlers, he ignored it and did not appear at the hearing. So he defied a bench warrant, is how it amounts. What it amounts to. The defendant was never a threat to the Islamic community. He was only there at the request of the FBI to see if he could uncover any terrorist activity. He was recruited by the FBI to act as an informant. He presents no danger to the Islamic community. However, the mere existence of this restraining order in the public record has a serious impact on the defendant and his family by restricting his movement, and the fact that this order exists in the public record has a serious impact on his ability to obtain employment. So, what happened is that after all this went down, after they managed to use this guy to set up a bogus prosecution of somebody who, by virtue of being an Afghan who is distantly related to somebody suspected of involvement in Al-Qaeda, after this all went down, this guy's left with the fact that a restraining order was issued against him, and he has legal complications from his time as an agent provocateur in the service of the FBI. now that this restraining order exists, there's this court order against him, suddenly he finds it difficult to go out and get a job. So he was left twisting in the wind. But the point I'm making here is that the FBI does this all the time, and it's not just the Muslims who were targeted. It's anybody who belongs to a group that can be isolated, demonized, defined as outside the mainstream, dehumanized, disenfranchised, and ultimately liquidated. That's what happened to the Branch Davidians. In a minor but related way, that's what's happening to the family of Cheyenne Irish. This sort of thing happens all the time in this country, and it's only getting worse because this is the lifeblood of the regime. This type of manufactured controversy, this type of prefabricated outrage, it's indispensable for the purposes of the system that they find people who can be defined as political criminals. And when they can't find them, they'll go out and make their own. Thanks for joining me this week. I'll be back next week with another harangue, another jeremiade of outrage over what's happening to this country that I love so much and that you love too. Have a wonderful Lord's Day tomorrow. Please join me online at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. It's probably going to be updated over the weekend with more developments in the story out of New Hampshire. And take care until we meet again. And as always, Doom Spirito Pugno. While I breathe, I fight. Good night, good luck, and God bless.